It's time for our Shapiroette. Bruce, what a week. Dive in at any end of the pool.
Well, I should also doff my own yarmulke at the death of my New Haven neighbor, Harold Bloom, who was such a huge intellectual presence at Yale and beyond. You know, we could start almost anywhere this week, but just because things have been moving so fast, for that very reason, I want to back off the immediate moment and talk instead about a little holiday we had yesterday, Columbus Day. You know, when I was a kid, we all memorized this little line. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And, you know, this is the holiday in which we celebrate the discovery of America. But right now, bubbling beneath the surface, there's this really interesting controversy. Whether instead of celebrating Columbus Day, we should be acknowledging the people who were here before Europe discovered America, and acknowledge as well the huge genocide that Columbus and European colonists brought in their wake. So there's a move to change the first Monday in October to Indigenous Peoples Day. Now, you'd think, okay, that's a fairly simple cultural argument to have. Yeah, there are Columbus Day, Columbus statues all over the place. There's one a mile down from my office here on Broadway in Columbus Circle, another one not too far from my house in New Haven in Worcester Square. There's a Columbus statue. Pretty much every city in the country has it. And therein lies a more complicated story, which gets you in some ways to the heart of the divisive politics of the moment. Because while it's true that Columbus Day, in one reading of history, celebrates the colonization and genocide of the peoples of the Americas, Columbus Day as a holiday was also established back in the 20th century to combat anti-Italian immigrant sentiment, and in particular was championed as a response to the lynching of Italian-American immigrants in New Orleans, who were regarded early in the 20th century as more African than American, who were subject to enormous racism and, in some parts of the country, violence. So that when we tell the story of America, we tell the story of Columbus Day, it's history is not simple. It's about contending or perhaps harmonizing narratives of persecution and narratives of violence. And
Bruce, as an honorary Australian, something that I bestowed upon you some time ago, you'd be aware that Captain Cook is a similarly problematic figure in this country.
Well, indeed. The additional complicating layer, and this is what relates it to, you know, today's debates over immigration and migration, is this way that Columbus was seized upon by an embattled immigrant community in the early phases of its own assimilation and is still tremendously important to Italian Americans in the U.S. So, you know, the American story that leads us to the moment of Trump and leads us to huge arguments over the border and immigration and migration, and leads us as well to President Trump's attempt to race bait one of his Democratic rivals, Elizabeth Warren, over and over again because of her one-time claim to Indian heritage. All of that runs through this federal holiday we just celebrated yesterday.
I bet Trump's up on his pedestal saying three cheers for Columbus.
He I think he's got a few other things on his mind. Last I heard, he was tweeting a little bit more about countries far to the east of here.
I'll be talking to Joost Hiltermann next about the Turkey's offensive in Syria. But breaking news is that, you know, Trump's talking about doing a demolition job on Turkey. One of the problems, Bruce, is they've got stacks of American nuclear bombs in Turkey. Let's cogitate about that for a moment. Okay, an impeachment update, if you please.
Well, these things are all interrelated. You know, we've got, what a week on the Ukraine scandal. We have to say, a week that began with the revelation with the arrest of Rudolph Giuliani's two Ukrainian fixers, Misters Furman and Farnas, with one-way tickets on their way to Europe and being arrested at Dulles Airport, only to give us two of the more memorable mugshots in recent history. And as recently as last night, we learned that former National Security Advisor John Bolton was the person who blew the whistle in part on Giuliani's machinations around Ukraine, saying...
Suddenly my heart warms to Bolton.
Well, he calls Rudolph Giuliani a hand grenade and says, I am not part of whatever drug deal Sondland, that's the EU ambassador, and Mulvaney, what has Giuseppe cooking up. You know, that's a wonderful quote. And he is the guy who called the cops. We also had we also had testimony yesterday from Fiona Hill, another former National Security Council aide, who talked about evidently talked about the president's lawyer running what's being described as a shadow foreign policy in Ukraine. You know, the White House has been trying to stonewall, to prevent officials from testifying, but you've had two remarkable phenomena. One is that you've had diplomats technically still on staff but on leave, like former Ukraine Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, simply ignoring the State Department's orders to not testify, and they're responding to subpoenas, showing up and testifying. And then you also have the huge number of officials like Bolton and like Fiona Hill, who testified yesterday, who've been alienated by this White House and have no reason for loyalty. So the Ukraine scandal is escalating, and we're getting an ever deeper picture of the degree of the Trump administration's determination to shake down the Ukrainian government for President Trump's political interests and to pursue the completely baseless theory, which seems to have obsessed President Trump, about Hunter Biden and Hunter Biden's service on the board of Burisma, the Ukrainian gas company.
It's interesting that Biden Senior Joe has made a public proclamation that none of his family will have offices in the White House.
Well, yes, and of course he's in the uncomfortable position of needing to do this on the one hand, since at a minimum he was dealing with some genuinely bad judgment on his son's part in going into the service of a Ukrainian oligarch. And again, there was no illegality in it, but certainly being a family member of the Vice President of the United States, you know, cashing in a hot foreign policy zone like Ukraine is not the best political move. Of course, Biden is hoping this will cast a light on the current tenant of Pennsylvania Avenue's family and their enormous interests, Ivanka Trump's interests in Chinese branding, his son's interests in real estate in Turkey and India, all over the place. You know, the Trump administration is family conflict central. I think, unfortunately for Biden, that it may not be doing him a lot of good. Biden has now come out for impeachment, but of course he's done so long after Elizabeth Warren and some of the other candidates have, and he's coming out at a moment when his campaign, while doing still well among the professional Democratic class, seems to be struggling with parts of the Democratic electorate. We'll have to see. We have a big debate coming up tonight, and Biden has a lot on the line.
Okay, tell me what on earth possessed Trump to make Giuliani his personal lawyer. That seems to be one of the maddest decisions of your mad king.
Well, I think, look, Trump and Rudolph Giuliani have a long-standing relationship going way back to Giuliani's years as the then charismatic mayor of New York City. Since then, their relationship has deepened because post-political life and post the failure of his own presidential ambitions, Rudy Giuliani has hung out and hung his fortunes with the same bunch of money launderers and fast money real estate people that Trump has. They very much are birds of a feather. They have been pals for a long time, and I think Trump likes Giuliani's flamboyant style. Giuliani, after all, is a guy who held a press conference once to announce his divorce before he told the woman he was married to. So, you know, there's a certain similarity here. And, of course, Giuliani was one of the first Republicans to come out in support of the Trump presidential campaign way back in 2016.
Now, I know that you and Bernie are close as we'll get out, and I'd like you to offer my pacemaker to Bernie, because I understand he's got some heart trouble. I'll lend it to him for the duration of the campaign.
Well, Bernie has a very big job to do at the debate tonight. Coming after his heart attack, this will be his first major public appearance, the first chance for him to show that concern about his age is or is not relevant. I think beneath the surface, Bernie faces another challenge, which is that some of the wind that powered his sails so effectively in 2016 has shifted to Elizabeth Warren. Much of the progressive and dissenting vote within the Democratic Party the imagination has been seized by Warren's progressive campaign for the presidency. They have a close political friendship, and thus far in the campaign, they've avoided attacking each other, understanding, I think, that the combined Sanders-Warren constituencies represent a major force. Indeed, in the current polls, the two combined Warren Sanders constituencies are outpolling Joe Biden. This is significant, but it's also true that they both are sitting on constituencies who are volatile, who could go elsewhere, or who, in the case of Bernie, include many people who might otherwise not vote, or might in some cases vote for third party candidates. So Bernie has a lot on the line. The progressives in the Democratic Party have a lot on the line in how Bernie handles questions about his health, questions about the viability of his campaign at a moment when Elizabeth Warren's numbers have been going up and up and up.
Thanks for your time, Bruce.